This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator, written and read by Ryan Holiday.
Introduction. If you were being kind, you would say that my job is in marketing and public relations, or online strategy and advertising. But that's a polite veneer to hide the harsh truth. I am, to put it bluntly, a media manipulator. I am paid to deceive. My job is to lie to the media so they can lie to you. I cheat, bribe, and connive for best-selling authors and billion-dollar brands and abuse my understanding of the internet to do so. I have funneled millions of dollars to blogs through advertising. I've given breaking news to blogs instead of Good Morning America, and when that didn't work, hired their family members. I have flown bloggers across the country, boosted their revenue by buying traffic, written their stories for them, fabricated elaborate ruses to capture their attention, and courted them with expensive meals and scoops. It's why I found myself at 2 a.m. one morning at a deserted intersection in Los Angeles, dressed in all black. In my hand, I had tape and some obscene stickers made at Kinko's earlier in the afternoon. What was I doing here? I was there to deface billboards, specifically billboards I had designed and paid for. Not that I expected to do anything like this, but there I was, doing it. My girlfriend, coaxed into being my accomplice, was behind the wheel of the getaway car. After I finished, we circled the block and I took photos of my work from the passenger window, as if I'd spotted it from the road. Across the billboards was now a 2-foot-long sticker that implied that the movie's creator, my friend, Tucker Max, deserved to have his dick caught in a trap with sharp metal hooks, or something like that. As soon as I got home, I dashed off 2 emails to 2 major blogs. Under the fake name Evan Meyer, I wrote, "I saw these on my way home last night. It was on 3rd and Crescent Heights, I think. Good to know Los Angeles hates Tucker Max too," and attached the photos. One blog wrote back, "You're not messing with me, are you?" "No," I said. "Trust me, I'm not lying." The vandalized billboards and the coverage that my photos received were just a small part of the deliberately provocative campaign that I did for the movie I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell. My friend Tucker had asked me to create some controversy around the movie, which was based on his best-selling book, and I did, somewhat effortlessly, it turns out. It is one of many campaigns I have done in my career, and by no means an unusual one. But it illustrates a part of the media system that is hidden from your view, how the news is created and driven by marketers, and no one does anything to stop it. In under 2 weeks, and with no budget, thousands of college students protested the movie on their campuses nationwide. Angry citizens vandalized our billboards in multiple neighborhoods. FoxNews.com ran a front-page story about the backlash. Page 6 of the New York Post made their first of many mentions of Tucker, and the Chicago Transit Authority banned and stripped the movie's advertisements from their buses. To cap it all off, 2 different editorials railing against the film ran in the Washington Post and Chicago Tribune the week it was released. The outrage about Tucker was great enough that a few years later, it was written into the popular television show Portlandia on IFC. I guess it's safe to admit now that the entire firestorm was, essentially, fake. I designed the advertisements, which I bought and placed around the country, and then promptly called and left anonymous complaints about them, and leaked copies of my complaints to blogs for support. I alerted college LGBT and women's rights groups to screenings in their area and baited them to protest our offensive movie at the theater, knowing that the nightly news would cover it. I started a boycott group on Facebook. I orchestrated fake tweets and posted fake comments to articles online. I even won a contest for being the first one to send in a picture of a defaced ad in Chicago. Thanks for the free t-shirt, Chicago Red Eye. Oh, also, that photo was from New York. I manufactured preposterous stories about Tucker's behavior on and off the movie set and reported them to gossip websites, which gleefully repeated them. I paid for anti-woman ads on feminist websites and anti-religion ads on Christian websites, knowing each would write about it. Sometimes I just photoshopped ads onto screenshots of the websites and got coverage for controversial ads that never actually ran. The loop became final when, for the first time in history, I put out a press release to answer my own manufactured criticism. Tucker Max responds to CTA decision. Blow me, the headline read. Hello, shitstorm of press. Hello, number one on the New York Times bestseller list. I pulled this off with no connections, no money, no footsteps to follow. But because of the way that blogging is structured, from the way bloggers are paid by the page view to the way that blog posts must be written to catch the reader's attention, this is all very easy to do. The system eats up the kind of material I produce. So as the manufactured storm I created played itself out in the press, real people started believing it, and it became true. My full-time job then and now is director of marketing for American Apparel, a clothing company known for its provocative imagery and unconventional business practices. But I orchestrate these deceptions for other high-profile clients as well, from authors who sell millions of books to entrepreneurs worth hundreds of millions of dollars. I create and shape the news for them. Usually, it's a simple hustle. Someone pays me, I manufacture a story for them, and we trade it up the chain, from a tiny blog to Gawker, to a website of a local news network, to the Huffington Post, to the major newspapers, to cable news and back again, until the unreal becomes real. Sometimes I start by planning a story. Sometimes I put out a press release or ask a friend to break a story on their blog. Sometimes I leak a document. Sometimes I fabricate a document and leak that. Really, it can be anything, from vandalizing a Wikipedia page to producing an expensive viral video. However the play starts, the end is the same. The economics of the internet are exploited to change public perception and sell product. Now, I was hardly a wide-eyed kid when I left school to do this kind of PR full-time. I'd seen enough in the edit wars of Wikipedia and the politics of power users in social media to know that something questionable was going on behind the scenes. Half of me knew all this, but another part of me remained a believer. I had my choice of projects. I only worked on what I believed in. And yes, that included Tucker Max and American Apparel. But I got sucked into the media underworld, getting hit after publicity hit for my clients, and propagating more and more lies to do so. I struggled to keep parts of me separate as I began to understand the media environment I was working in, and that there was something more than a little off about it. It worked until it stopped working for me. Though I wish I could pinpoint the moment when it all fell apart, when I realized the whole thing was a giant con, I can't. All I know is that eventually, I did. I studied the economics and ecology of online media deeply in the pursuit of my craft. I wanted to understand not just how, but why it worked, from the technology down to the personalities of the people who use it. As an insider with access, I saw things that academics and gurus and many bloggers themselves will never see. Publishers liked to talk to me because I controlled multi-million-dollar online advertising budgets, and they were often shockingly honest. I began to make connections among these pieces of information and see patterns in history. In books decades out of print, I saw criticism of media loopholes that had now reopened. I watched as basic psychological precepts were violated or ignored by bloggers as they reported the news. Having seen that much of the edifice of online publishing was based on faulty assumptions and self-serving logic, I learned that I could outsmart it. This knowledge both scared and emboldened me at the same time. I confess I turned around and used this knowledge against the public interest and for my own gain. An obscure item I found in the course of my research stopped me cold. It was a mention of a 1913 editorial cartoon published in the long-since-defunct Leslie's Illustrated Weekly newspaper. The cartoon, it said, showed a businessman throwing coins in the mouth of a giant fang-bared monster of many arms which stood menacingly in front of him. Each of its tentacle-like arms, which were destroying the city around it, was tattooed with words like cultivating hate, distorting facts, and slush to inflame. The man is an advertiser, and the mouth belongs to the malicious yellow press that needs his money to survive. Underneath is the caption, "The fool who feeds the monster." I knew I had to find this century-old drawing, though I wasn't sure why. As I rode the escalator through the glass canyon of the atrium and into the bowels of the central branch of the Los Angeles Public Library to search for it, it struck me that I wasn't just looking for some rare old newspaper. I was looking for myself. I knew who that fool was. He was me. In addiction circles, those in recovery also use the image of the monster as a warning. They tell the story of a man who found a package on his porch. Inside was a little monster, but it was cute, like a puppy. He kept it and raised it. The more he fed it, the bigger it got, and the more it needed to be fed. He ignored his worries as it grew bigger, more intimidating, demanding, and unpredictable, until one day, as he was playing with it, the monster attacked and nearly killed him. The realization that the situation was more than he could handle came too late. The man was no longer in control. The monster had a life of its own. The story of the monster is a lot like my story, except my story is not about drugs or the yellow press, but of a bigger and much more modern monster. My monster is the brave new world of new media, one that I often fed and thought I controlled. I lived high and well in that world and believed in it until it no longer looked the same to me. Many things went down. I'm not sure where my responsibility for them begins or ends, but I am ready to talk about what happened. I created false perceptions through blogs, which led to bad conclusions and wrong decisions. Real decisions in the real world that had consequences for real people. Phrases like known rapist began to follow what were once playfully encouraged rumors of bad or shocking behavior designed to get blog publicity for clients. Friends were ruined or broken. Gradually, I began to notice work just like mine appearing everywhere, and no one catching on to it or repairing the damage. Stocks took major hits to the tunes of tens of millions of dollars on news from the same unreliable sources I'd often trick with fake stories. In 2008, a Gawker blogger published emails stolen from my inbox by someone else trying to intimidate a client through the media. It was a humiliating and awful experience, but with some distance, I now understand that Gawker had little choice about the role they played in the matter. I know that I was as much a part of the problem as they were. I remember one day mentioning some scandal during a dinner conversation, one that I knew was probably fake, probably a scam. I did it because it was too interesting not to pass along. I was lost in the same unreality that I'd forced on other people. I found that not only did I not know what was real anymore, but that I no longer cared. To borrow from Bud Schulberg's description of a media manipulator in his classic novel, The Harder They Fall, I was, quote, indulging myself in the illusions that we can deal in filth without becoming the thing we touch, end quote. I no longer have those illusions. Winston Churchill wrote of the appeasers of his age that, quote, each one hopes that if he feeds the crocodile enough, the crocodile will eat him last, end quote. I was even more delusional. I thought I could skip being devoured entirely. It would never turn on me. I was in control. I was the expert. But I was wrong. Why I wrote this book. Sitting next to my desk right now is a large box filled with hundreds of articles I have printed over the last several years. The articles show all the trademarks of the fakes and scams I myself have run, yet they involve many of the biggest news and entertainment stories of the decade. The margins are filled with angry little notes and question marks. The satirist Juvenal wrote of, quote, cramming whole notebooks with scribbled invective, end quote, amid the corrupt opulence of Rome. That box and this book are my notebooks, from my own days inside such a world. Collectively, it was this process that opened my eyes. I hope it will have the same effect for you. Lately, I've slowed my contributions to the pile of evidence, not because the quality of the content has improved, but because hope for anything different would be silly. I'm not so foolish as to expect bloggers to know what they're talking about. I no longer expect to be informed, not when manipulation is so easy for bloggers and marketers to profit from. I can't shake the constant suspicion that others are baiting, tricking, or cheating me, just as I did to them. It's hard to browse the internet when you're haunted by the words of AJ Delirio, the editor of the popular sports blog Deadspin. Quote, it's all professional wrestling, end quote. Some of you, by the time you're done with this audiobook, will probably hate me for ruining it for you too, or call me a liar, or accuse me of exaggerating. You may not want me to expose the people behind your favorite websites as the imbeciles, charlatans, and pompous frauds they are. But it is a world of many hustlers, and you are the mark. The con is to build a brand off the backs of others. Your attention and your credulity are what's stolen. This book isn't structured like typical business books. Instead of extended chapters, it's split into two parts, and each part is made of short, overlapping, and reinforcing vignettes. And in the first part, I explain why blogs matter, how they drive the news, and how they can be manipulated. In the second, I show what happens when you do this, how it backfires, and the dangerous consequences of our current system. What follows are the methods used to manipulate bloggers and reporters at the highest levels, broken down into 9 simple tactics. Every one of these tactics reveals a critical vulnerability in our media system. I will show you where they are and what can be done with them, and help you recognize when they're being used on you. Sure, I'm explaining how to take advantage of these weaknesses, but mostly I'm saying that these vulnerabilities exist. It is the first time that these gaps have ever been exposed, by a critic or otherwise. Hopefully, once in the open, they'll no longer work as well. I understand that there is some contradiction in this position, as there has long been in me. My disintegration wasn't always healthy, but it does allow me to explain our problems from a unique perspective. This book is my experience behind the scenes in the worlds of blogging, PR, and online machinations, and what those experiences say about the dominant cultural medium. I'm speaking personally and honestly about what I know, and I know this space better than just about anyone. I didn't intend to, but I've helped pioneer a media system designed to trick, cajole, and steal every second of the most precious resource in the world, people's time. I'm going to show you every single one of these tricks and what they mean. What you choose to do with this information is up to you. Book 1, Feeding the Monster, How Blogs Work. Chapter 1, Blogs Make the News. We play by their rules long enough, and it becomes our game. Orson Scott Card, Ender's Game. I call your attention to an article in the New York Times written at the earliest of the earliest junctures of the 2012 presidential election, nearly 2 years before votes would be cast. It told of a then-obscure figure, Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota. Pawlenty was not yet a presidential candidate. He had no campaign director, no bus, few donors, and little name recognition. In fact, he did not even have a campaign. It was January 2011, after all. What he did have was a beat reporter from the blog Politico following him from town to town with a camera and a laptop, reporting every moment of his non-campaign. It's a bit peculiar if you think about it. Even the New York Times, the newspaper that spends millions of dollars a year for a Baghdad bureau, which can fund investigative reports 5 or 10 years in the making, didn't have a reporter covering Pawlenty. Yet Politico, a blog with a fraction of the resources of a major newspaper, did. The Times was covering Politico, covering a non-candidate. It was a little like a Ponzi scheme, and like all such schemes, it went from boom to bust. Pawlenty became a candidate, coverage of him generated millions of impressions online, then in print, and finally on television, before he flamed out and withdrew from the race. Despite all this, his candidacy's impact on the election was significant and real enough that the next Republican frontrunner courted Pawlenty's endorsement. There's a famous 20th century political cartoon about the Associated Press that was, at the time, the wire service responsible for supplying news to the majority of the newspapers in the United States. In it, an AP agent is pouring different bottles into the city's water supply. The bottles are labeled lies, prejudice, slander, suppressed facts, and hatred. The image reads, "The news, poisoned at its source." I think of blogs as today's newswires. Blogs matter. By blog, I'm referring collectively to all online publishing. That's everything from Twitter accounts to major newspaper websites to web videos to group blogs with hundreds of writers. I don't care whether the owners consider themselves blogs or not. The reality is that they are all subject to the same incentives, and they fight for attention with similar tactics. Most people don't understand how today's information cycle really works. Most people have no idea how much their general worldview is influenced by the way news is generated online. What begins online ends offline. Although there are millions of blogs out there, you'll notice some mentioned a lot in this book. Gawker, Business Insider, Politico, BuzzFeed, Huffington Post, Drudge Report, and the like. This is not because they are the most widely read, but instead because they are mostly read by the media elite. And their proselytizing owners, Nick Denton, Henry Blogget, Jonah Peretti, and Arianna Huffington, have an immense amount of influence. A blog isn't small if its puny readership is made up of TV producers and writers for national newspapers. Radio DJs and news anchors once filled their broadcasts with newspaper headlines. Today they repeat what they read on blogs, certain blogs more than others. Stories from blogs also filter into real conversations and rumors that spread from person to person through word of mouth. In short, blogs are vehicles through which mass media reporters and your most chatty and informed friends discover and borrow the news. This hidden cycle gives birth to the memes that become our cultural references, the budding stars who become our celebrities, thinkers who become our gurus, and the news that becomes our news. When I figured this out early in my career in public relations, I thought what only a naive and destructively ambitious 20-something could have. If I master the rules that govern blogs, I can be the master of all they determined. It was, essentially, access to a fiat over culture. It may have been a dangerous thought, but it wasn't hyperbole. In the Pawlenty case, the guy could have become the president of the United States of America. One early media critic put it this way. We're a country governed by public opinion, and public opinion is largely governed by the press, so isn't it critical to understand what governs the press? What rules over the media, he concluded, rules over the country. In this case, what rules over Politico literally almost ruled over everyone. To understand what makes blogs act, why Politico followed Pawlenty around, is the key to making them do what you want. Learn their rules, change the game. That's all it takes to control public opinion. So why did Politico follow Pawlenty? On the face of it, it's pretty crazy. Pawlenty's phantom candidacy wasn't newsworthy, and if the New York Times couldn't afford to pay a reporter to follow him around, Politico shouldn't have been able to. It wasn't crazy. Blogs need things to cover. The Times has to fill a newspaper only once per day. A cable news channel has to fill 24 hours of programming 365 days a year. But blogs have to fill an infinite amount of space. The site that covers the most stuff wins. Political blogs know that their traffic goes up during election cycles. Since traffic is what they sell to advertisers, elections equal increased revenue. Unfortunately, election cycles come only every few years. Worse still, they end. Blogs have a simple solution. Change reality through the coverage. With Pawlenty, Politico was not only manufacturing a candidate, they were manufacturing an entire leg of an election cycle purely to profit from it. It was a conscious decision. In the story about his business, Politico's executive editor, Jim Vandehei, tipped his hand to the New York Times. Quote, "We were a garage band in 2008, riffing on the fly. Now we're a 200-person production with a precise feel and plan. We're trying to make a leap forward in front of everyone else. End quote. When a blog like Politico tried to leap in front of everyone else, the person they arbitrarily decided to cover was turned into an actual candidate. The campaign starts gradually, with a few mentions on blogs, moves on to potential contender, begins to be considered for debates, and is then included on the ballot. Their platform accumulates real supporters who donate real time and money to the campaign. The campaign buzz is reified by the mass media, who covers and legitimizes whatever is being talked about online. Pawlenty's campaign for elected office may have failed, but for blogs and other media, it was a profitable success. He generated millions of page views for blogs, and was the subject of dozens of stories in print and online, and had his fair share of television time. When Politico picked up Pawlenty, they made the only bet worth making, where they had the power to control the outcome. In case you didn't catch it, here's the cycle again. Political blogs need things to cover. Traffic increases during election. Reality, the election being far away, does not align with this. Political blogs create candidates early, moving up the start of the election cycle. The person they cover, by nature of coverage, becomes an actual candidate for president. Blogs profit, literally, and the public loses. You'll see this cycle repeated again and again in this audio program. It's true for celebrity gossip, politics, business news, and every other topic blogs cover. The constraints of blogging create artificial content, which is made real and impacts the outcome of real-world events. The economics of the internet created a twisted set of incentives that make traffic more important and more profitable than the truth. With the mass media, and today mass culture, relying on the web for the next big thing, it is a set of incentives with massive implications. Blogs need traffic, being first drives traffic, and so entire stories are created out of whole cloth to make that happen. This is just one facet of the economics of blogging, but it's a critical one. When we understand the logic that drives these business choices, those choices become predictable. And what is predictable can be anticipated, redirected, accelerated, or controlled, however you and I choose. Later in the election, Politico moved the goalposts again to stay on top. Speed stopped working so well, so they turned to scandal to upend the race once more. Remember Herman Cain, the preposterous media-created candidate who came after Pawlenty? After surging ahead as the lead contender for the Republican nomination and becoming the subject of an exhausting number of traffic-friendly blog posts, Cain's candidacy was utterly decimated by a sensational but still strongly denied scandal reported by, you guessed it, Politico. I'm sure there were powerful political interests that could not allow Cain to become anything more than a sideshow, so his narrative was changed, and some suspect it was done by a person just like me, hired by another candidate's campaign, and the story spread, whether it was true or not. If true, from the looks of it, whoever delivered the fatal blow did it exactly the way I would have done, painfully, untraceably, and impossible to recover from. And so another non-candidate was created, made real, and then taken out. Another one bit the dust so that blogs could fill their cycle. Chapter 2. How to Turn Nothing into Something in 3 Way Too Easy Steps. Some people in the press, I think, are just lazy as hell. There are times when I pitch a story and they do it word for word. That's just embarrassing. They're adjusting to a time that demands less quality and more quantity, and it works to my advantage most of the time because I think most reporters have liked me packaging things for them. Most people will opt for whatever's easier, so they can move on to the next thing. Reporters are measured by how often their stuff gets on Drudge. It's a bad way to be, but it's reality. Kurt Bardella, former press secretary for Republican Congressman Daryl Issa. In the introduction, I explained a scam I call trading up the chain. It's a strategy I developed that manipulates the media through recursion. I can turn nothing into something by placing a story with a small blog that has very low standards, which then becomes the source for a story by a larger blog, and that, in turn, for a story by larger media outlets. I create, to use the words of one media scholar, a self-reinforcing news wave. People like me do this every day. The work I do is not exactly respectable, but I want to explain how it works without any of the negatives associated with my infamous clients. I'll show how I manipulated the media for a good cause. A friend of mine recently used some of my advice on trading up the chain for the benefit of the charity he runs. This friend needed to raise money to cover the costs of a community art project and chose to do it through Kickstarter, the crowdsourced fundraising platform. With just a few days' work, he turned an obscure cause into a popular internet meme and raised nearly $10,000 to expand the charity internationally. Following my instructions, he made a YouTube video for the Kickstarter page showing off his charity's work. Not a video of the charity's best work or even its most important work. but the work that exaggerated certain elements aimed at helping the video spread. In this case, two or three examples in exotic locations that actually had the least amount of community benefit. Next, he wrote a short article for a small local blog in Brooklyn and embedded the video. This site was chosen because its stories were often used or picked up by the New York section of the Huffington Post. As expected, the Huffington Post did bite, and ultimately featured the story as local news in both New York City and Los Angeles. Following my advice, he sent an email from a fake address with these links to a reporter at CBS in Los Angeles, who then did a television piece on it, using mostly clips from my friend's heavily edited video. In anticipation of all this, he'd been active on a channel of the social news site Reddit, where users vote on stories and topics they like, during the weeks leading up to his campaign launch in order to build up some connections on the site. When the CBS News piece came out and the video was up, he was ready to post it all on Reddit. It made the front page almost immediately. This score on Reddit, now bolstered by the other press as well, put the story in the radar of what I call the major cool stuff blogs, sites like Boing Boing, Laughing Squid, Found, and others, since they get post ideas from Reddit. From this final burst of coverage, money began pouring in, as did volunteers, recognition, and new ideas. With no advertising budget, no publicist, no experience, his little video did nearly 500,000 views and funded his project for the next 2 years. It went from nothing to something. This may have all been for charity, but it still raises a critical question. What exactly happened? How was it so easy for him to manipulate the media, even for a good cause? He turned one exaggerated amateur video into a news story that was written about independently by dozens of outlets in dozens of markets and did millions of media impressions. It even registered nationally. He had created and then manipulated this attention entirely by himself. Before you get upset at us, remember, we are only doing what Lindsay Robertson, a blogger from Video Gum, Jezebel, and New York Magazine's Vulture blog, taught us to do. In a post explaining to publicists how they could better gain bloggers like herself, Lindsay advised focusing, quote, on the lower traffic tier with the correct understanding that these days, content filters up as much as it filters down. And often the smaller sites, with their ability to dig deeper into the internet and be more nimble, act as farm teams for the larger ones. End quote. Proving this theory unnervingly correct, Newsweek picked up Lindsay's advice from her tiny personal blog and reposted it on the official Newsweek Tumblr. Blogs have enormous influence over other blogs, making it possible to turn a post on a site with only a little traffic into posts on much bigger sites, if the latter happens to be read by the former. Blogs compete to get to stories first, newspapers compete to confirm it, and then pundits compete for airtime to opine on it. The smaller sites legitimize the newsworthiness of the story for the sites with bigger audiences. Consecutively and concurrently, this pattern inherently distorts and exaggerates whatever they cover. The lay of the land. Here's how it works. There are thousands of bloggers scouring the web looking for things to write about. They must write about several things each day. They search Twitter, Facebook, comment sections, press releases, rival blogs, and other sources to develop their material. Above them are hundreds of mid-level online and offline journalists on websites and blogs and in magazines and newspapers who use those bloggers below them as sources and filters. They also have to write constantly and engage in the same search for buzz, only a little more developed. Above them are the major national websites, publications, and television stations. They in turn browse the scourers below them for their material, grabbing their leads and turning them into truly national conversations. These are the most influential bunch, the New York Times, the Today Show, and CNN, and dwindling revenues or not, they have massive reach. Finally, between, above, and throughout these concentric levels is the largest group, us, the audience. We scan the web for material that we can watch, comment on, and share with our friends or followers. It's bloggers informing bloggers informing bloggers all the way down. This isn't anecdotal observation, it is fact. In a media monitoring study done by CISN and George Washington University, 89% of journalists reported using blogs for their research for stories. Roughly half reported using Twitter to find and research stories, and more than two-thirds use other social networks such as Facebook or LinkedIn in the same way. The more immediate the nature of their publishing mediums, blogs, then newspapers and magazines, the more heavily a journalist will depend on sketchy online sources, like social media, for research. Recklessness, laziness, however you want to categorize it, the attitude is openly tolerated and acknowledged. The majority of journalists surveyed admitted to knowing that their online sources were less reliable than traditional ones. Not a single journalist said that they believed that the information gathered from social media was, quote, a lot more reliable, end quote, than traditional media. Why? Because it suffers from, quote, a lack of fact-checking, verification, or reporting standards, end quote. For the sake of simplicity, though, let's break the chain into three levels. I know these levels as one thing only, beachheads for manufacturing news. I don't think that someone could have designed a system easier to manipulate if they wanted to. Level 1, the entry point. At the first level, small blogs and hyperlocal websites that cover your neighborhood or particular scene are some of the easiest to get traction on. Since they typically write about local, personal issues pertaining to a contained readership, trust is very high. At the same time, they are cash-strapped and traffic-hungry, always on the lookout for a big story that might draw a big spike of new viewers. It doesn't have to be local, though. It can be a site about a subject you know very well, or it can be a site run by a friend. What's important is that the site is small and understaffed. This makes it possible to sell them a story that is only loosely connected to their core message, but really sets you up to transition to the next level. Level 2, the legacy media. Here we begin to see a mix of online and offline sources. The blogs of newspapers and local television stations are some of the best targets. For starters, they share the same URL and often get aggregated in Google News. Places like the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, and CBS all have sister sites like Smart Money, Main Street, BNet, and others that feature the company's logos, but have their own editorial standards, not always as rigorous as their old media counterparts. They seem legitimate, but are, as FARC.com founder Drew Curtis calls them, just, quote, mass media sections that update more often, but with less editorial oversight, end quote. Legacy media outlets are critical turning points in the buildup of momentum. The reality is that bloggers at Forbes.com or the Chicago Tribune don't operate with the same editorial standards as their print counterparts. However, their final output can be made to look like they carry the same weight. If you get a blog on Wired.com to mention your startup, you can smack a revolutionary device from Wired on the box of your product just as surely as you could if Wired had put your CEO on the cover of the magazine. These sites won't write about just anything, though. So you need to create chatter or a strong story angle to hook this kind of sucker. Their illusion of legitimacy comes at the cost of being slightly more selective when it comes to what they cover. But it is worth the price because it will grant the bigger websites in your sites later the privilege of using magic words like, quote, NBC is reporting, end quote. Level 3, national. Having registered multiple stories from multiple sources firmly onto the radar of both local and mid-level outlets, you can now leverage this coverage to get access to the highest level of media, the national press. Getting to this level usually involves less direct pushing and a lot more massaging. The sites that have already taken your bait are now on your side. They desperately want their articles to get as much traffic as possible, and being linked to or mentioned on national sites is how they do that. These sites will take care of submitting your articles to news aggregators like Dig, because making the front page will drive thousands of visitors to their articles. Mass media reporters monitor aggregators for story ideas and often cover what is trending there, like they did with the charity story after it made the front page of Reddit. In today's world, even these guys have to think like bloggers. They need to get as many page views as possible. Success on the lower levels of the media chain is evidence that the story could deliver even better results from a national platform. You just want to make sure that such reporters notice the story's gaining traction. Take the outlets where you'd ultimately like to receive coverage and observe it for patterns. You'll notice that they tend to get their story ideas from the same second-level sites, and by tailoring the story to those smaller sites, or site, it sets you up to be noticed by the larger one. The blogs on Gawker and Media Bistro, for instance, are read very heavily by the New York City media set. You can craft the story for those sites and automatically set yourself up to appeal to the other reporters reading it, without ever speaking to them directly. An example, Katie Couric claims that she gets many story ideas from her Twitter followers, which means that getting a few tweets out of the 700 or so people she follows is all that it takes to get a shot at the nightly national news. News anchors aren't the only people susceptible to this trick. Scott Venner, the famous hitmaker responsible for picking the songs that go on to HBO's trendiest shows like Entourage and How to Make It in America, has a reputation for discovering unknown artists. Really, he admits, most of the music he finds is just, quote, what is bubbling up on the internet, end quote. Since Venner monitors conversations on Twitter and the comments on trendy music blogs, a shot at a six-figure HBO payday and instant mainstream exposure is just a few manufactured bubbles away. It's a simple illusion. Create the perception that the meme already exists, and all the reporter or the music supervisor or celebrity stylist is doing is popularizing it. They rarely bother to look past first impressions. Levels 1, 2, and 3, how I traded up the chain. My campaign for I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell began by vandalizing the billboards. The graffiti was designed to bait two specific sites, Curb Los Angeles and Media Bistro's Fishbowl LA. When I sent them photos of my work under the fake name Evan Meyer, they both quickly picked it up. For his contributions as a tipster, Evan earned his own Media Bistro profile, which still exists. According to the site, he has not been cited since. Curbed LA began their post by using my email verbatim. Quote, a reader writes, I saw these on my way home last night. It was on 3rd and Crescent Heights, I think. Good to know Los Angeles hates him too. Provocateur Tucker Max's new movie, I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell, opens this weekend. Thanks for the plug. In creating outrage for the movie, I had a lot of luck getting local websites to cover and spread the news about protests of screenings that we had organized through anonymous tips. It is standard practice in journalism that the identity of anonymous sources must be shared with the editor so they know that the person is real and the writer hasn't been tricked. I've been used as an anonymous source for blogs dozens of times. No one has ever asked me my identity. I've never been verified, and I've never spoken to an editor. They were the easiest place to get the story started. We would send them a few offensive quotes and say something like, this misogynist is coming to our school and we're so fucking pissed. Can you help spread the word? Or I'd email to a neighborhood site and say, quote, a controversial screening with rumors of a local boycott was happening in a few days. Sex, college protesters in Hollywood. It was the definition of the kind of local news story producers love. After reading about the growing controversy on the small blogs I'd conned, they would often send camera crews to the screenings. The video of the story would get posted on the station's website, and then get covered again by other, larger blogs in that city, like those hosted by a newspaper or companies like the Huffington Post. I was able to get the story to register, however briefly, by using a small site with low standards of newsworthiness. Other media outlets might be alerted to this fact, and in turn cover it, giving me another bump. At this point, I now have something to work with. 3 or 4 links are the makings of a trend piece, or even a controversy. That's all major outlets and national websites need to see to get excited. Former Slate.com media critic Jack Schaefer called such manufactured online controversy frovocation, a portmanteau of faux and provocation. It works incredibly well. The key to getting from the second to the third level is the soft sell. I couldn't very well email a columnist at the Washington Post and say, hey, will you denounce our movie so we can benefit from the negative PR? So I targeted the sites that those kind of columnists were likely to read. Gawker and Media Bistro are very media-centric, so we tailored stories to them to cue ourselves up for outrage from their audience, which happened to include reporters at places like the Washington Post. In fact, a few years later, one of the sites we exploited repeatedly while promoting the movie wrote a post titled, Are Traditional News Media Outlets Stealing Scoops from Bloggers?, which accused the Chicago Tribune of stealing article ideas from her blog Chicago Now. She was right. They were stealing. And that's exactly how we got coverage into the editorial page of the Tribune. And when I want to be direct, I would register a handful of fake email addresses on Gmail or Yahoo and send emails with a collection of all the links gathered so far and say, hey, how have you not done a story about this yet? Reporters rarely get substantial tips or alerts from their readers, so to get 2 or even 3 legitimate tips about an issue is a strong signal. So I sent it to them. Well, kind of. I actually just did more of the same fake tips from fake email addresses that worked for the other sites. Only this time I had a handful of links from major blogs that made it clear that everyone was talking about it. At this point, something amazing happened. The coverage my stunts received began helping the $20,000 a month publicist the movie had hired. Rejections from late-night television, newspaper interviews, and morning radio turned into callbacks. Tucker did Carson Daly's NBC late-night show for the first time. By the end of this charade, hundreds of reputable reporters, producers, and bloggers had been swept up into participating. Thousands more had eagerly gobbled up news about it on multiple blogs. Each time they did, views of the movie trailer spiked, book sales increased, and Tucker became more famous and more controversial. If only people had known they were promoting the offensive Tucker Max brand for us. Just as we'd planned. With a few simple moves, I'd taken his story from level 1 to level 3, not just once, but several times, back and forth. Ultimately, the movie did not do nearly as well at release as we'd hoped. This supplementary guerrilla marketing ended up being the entirety of the movie's advertising efforts, rather than a small part of it, for reasons outside of my control. But the attention generated by the campaign was overwhelming and incredibly lucrative. Eventually, the movie became a cult hit on DVD. Once you get a story like this started, it takes on a life of its own. That's what happened after I vandalized Tucker's billboards. Exactly 1 week later, inspired by my example, 16 feminists gathered in New York City late at night to vandalize I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell posters all over Manhattan. Their campaign got even more coverage than my stunt, including a 650-word, three-picture story on a Village Voice blog with dozens of comments. I posted some comments under fake names to get people riled up, but looking at them now, I can't tell which ones are fake and which are real. From the fake came real action. The media, dancing with itself. Training up the chain relies on a concept created by crisis public relations expert Michael Citrick. While attempting to turn things around for a particularly disliked or controversial client, Citrick was fond of saying, "We need to find a lead steer. The media, like any group of animals, gallops in a herd. It takes just one steer to start a stampede. The first level is your lead steer. The rest is just pointing everyone's attention to the direction it went in. Remember, every person, with the exception of a few at the top layer, in this ecosystem is under immense pressure to produce content under the tightest of deadlines. Yes, you have something to sell. But more than ever, they desperately, desperately need to buy. The flimsiest of excuses is all it takes." It freaked me out when I began to see this sort of thing happen without the deliberate prodding of a promoter like myself. I saw media conflagrations set off by internal sparks. In this network, independent world of blogging, misinformation can spread even when no one is consciously pushing or manipulating it. The system is so primed, tuned, and ready that often it doesn't need people like me. The monster can feed itself. Sometimes a single quote taken out of context can set things off. In early 2011, a gossip reporter for an AOL entertainment blog asked former quarterback Kurt Warner, who he thought would be the next ex-athlete, to join the show Dancing with the Stars. Warner jokingly suggested Brett Favre, who was then embroiled in a sexual harassment scandal. Though the show told him they wanted nothing to do with Favre, the reporter still titled the post, "Brett Favre is Kurt Warner's pick to join Dancing. Controversy is good for ratings," and tagged it as an exclusive. The post made it clear that Warner was just goofing around. 2 days later, the blog Bleacher Report linked to the piece, but made it sound as though Warner was seriously urging Favre to join the show, which, remember, had just told AOL they wanted nothing to do with Favre. After their story, the rumor started to multiply rapidly. A reporter for the local TV news website KCCI Des Moines caught the story and wrote a 62-word piece titled "Brett Favre's Next Big Step?" and mentioned the rumors discussed on Bleacher Report. From there, the piece was picked up by USA Today. Brett Favre joining Dancing with the Stars Season 12 cast, Pro Football Talk, and others, making the full transition to the national stage. To recap what happened, a gossip blog manufactured a scoop by misrepresenting, deliberately or not, a joke. That scoop was itself misrepresented and misinterpreted as it traveled up the chain, going from a small entertainment blog to a sports site to a CBS affiliate in Iowa, and eventually to the website of one of the biggest newspapers in the country. This was excellently caught and detailed by Quickish in its post, "Brett Favre on Dancing with the Stars? No, not even a rumor." Their research was promptly stolen and reposted by the oft-guilty Deadspin for an easy 25,000 page views. What spread was not even a rumor, which at least would have been logical. It was just an empty bit of nothing. The fake Favre meme spread almost exactly along the lines of my fake outrage campaign for Tucker's movie. Only there was no me involved. The media is hopelessly interdependent. Not only is the web susceptible to spreading false information, but it can also be the source of it. For a gossip story, it's not a big deal, but the same weakness creates the opportunity for dangerous, even deadly abuses of the system. A true fool feeding the monster. I'm obviously jaded and cynical about trading up the chain. How could I not be? It's basically possible to run anything through this chain, even utterly preposterous and made-up information. For a long time, I thought that fabricated media stories could only hurt feelings and waste time. I didn't think anyone could die because of it. I was wrong. Perhaps you remember Terry Jones, the idiotic pastor whose burning of the Quran in March 2011 led to riots that killed nearly 30 people in Afghanistan. Jones' bigotry happened to trade up the chain perfectly, and the media unwittingly allowed it. Jones first made a name for himself in the local Florida press by running offensive billboards in front of his church. Then he stepped it up, announcing that he planned to stage a burning of the Quran. This story was picked up by a small website called Religion News Service. Yahoo linked to their short article, and dozens of blogs followed, which led CNN to invite Jones to appear on the network. He was now a national story. Yet the media and the public, aware of the potential implications of airing such a video of his act, began to push back. Many decided they would not air such a video. Some 500 people attended a protest in Kabul where they burned Jones in effigy. At the last second, Jones, under pressure, backed down, and the crisis was averted. But Terry Jones was back a few months later, announcing for the second time that he planned to burn the Quran. Each blog and outlet that covered the lead-up to the burning made the story, and the media monster that was Terry Jones, that much bolder and bigger. Reporters asked if a direct request from President Obama would stop him, which of course meant that the President of the United States of America would have to negotiate with a homegrown terrorist. He traded up the chain to the most powerful man in the world. This circus was what finally pushed Jones over the edge. In 2011, he went through with the burning, despite the threatened media blackout. He called their bluff and it worked. The blackout fell apart when a college student named Andrew Ford, freelancing for the French press agency, took advantage of the story too dirty and dangerous for many journalists to touch in good conscience. This happens in politics all the time, as Democratic consultant Christian Grantham told Forbes, quote, "Campaigns understand that there are some stories that regular reporters won't print, so they give those stories to the blogs." The French press agency, Ford's publisher, is syndicated on Google and Yahoo News. They immediately republished his article. The story began to go up the chain, getting bigger and bigger. Roughly 30 larger blogs and online news services had picked up Ford's piece or linked to it in the first day. It made the story too big for the rest of the media, including the foreign press, to continue to resist. So the news of Jones's Quran burning, a calculated stunt to extract attention from a system that could not prevent itself from being exploited, came known to the world, and it was a deadly monster of a story. Within days, 27 people were killed during riots in Afghanistan, including 7 UN workers. 40 more were injured. Christians were specifically targeted, and Taliban flags were flown in the streets of Kabul. Quote, "It took just one college student to defeat a media blackout and move a story halfway around the globe within 24 hours, the Poynter Institute wrote in an analysis of the reporting. This was, as a Forbes journalist put it, truly an example of when journalism 2.0 kills. One kook, one overeager young journalist, unintentionally show why trading up the chain, beating the monster, can be so dangerous. Though for Jones, very effective. They weren't just turning nothing into something. The beast these blogs built up set off needless bloodshed. You can trade up the chain for charity, or you can trade it up to create funny fake news, or you can do it to create violence, hatred, or even incidentally, death. I've done the first two, while others, out of negligence or malice, have done the latter. At the end of the day, intentions are not a justification I'm going to hide behind. There's more than enough blame to go around." Chapter 3. The Blog Con: How Publishers Make Money Online. Media companies can very much be in a race against time for growth. Investors want a return on their money, and, given the economics of web news, that almost always requires exponential growth in uniques and page views. Ryan McCarthy, Reuters. Picture a galley rowed by slaves and commanded by pirates. Tim Rutten, Los Angeles Times, on the Huffington Post business model. Stripped bare, the economics of online news, the way blogging really works, is a shocking thing. I've never been desperate enough to need to work inside the system as a lowly, unpaid blogger, but as an outsider, a press agent, and a media buyer, I saw plenty. What I learned is the ways that sites such as AOL, the Huffington Post, and even the website of the New York Times make their money, and how much money they actually make. This matters because as businesses designed to make money, the way in which they do business is the main filter for how they do the news. Every story they produce must contort itself to fit this mold, whatever the topic or subject. I will show you this by explaining exactly how I've exploited these economics for my own personal gain. You're free to view these lessons as opportunities or as loopholes that must be closed. I see them as both. Traffic is money. On the face of it, blogs make their money from selling advertisements. These advertisements are paid for by the impression, generally a rate per 1,000 impressions. A site may have several ad units on each page. A publisher's revenue equals the combined CPM, cost per 1,000, multiplied by the number of page views. Advertisements times traffic equals revenue. An ad buyer like me buys this space by the millions. 10 million impressions from this site, 5 million on another, 50 million through a network. A few blogs produce a portion of their revenue through selling extras, hosting conferences, or affiliate deals. But for the most part, this is the business. Traffic is money. A portion of the advertising on blogs is sold directly by the publisher, a portion is sold by sales reps who work on commission, and the rest is sold by advertising networks that specialize in the remaining inventory. Regardless of who sells it or who buys it, what matters is that every ad impression on a site is monetized, if only for a few pennies. Each and every page view is money in the pocket of the publisher. Publishers and advertisers can't differentiate between the types of impressions an ad does on a site. A perusing reader is no better than an accidental reader. An article that provides worthwhile advice is no more valuable than one instantly forgotten. So long as the page loads and the ads are seen, both sides are fulfilling their purpose. A click is a click. Knowing this, blogs do everything they can to increase the latter variable in the equation, traffic and page views. It's how you must understand them as a business. Every decision a publisher makes is ruled by one dictum: traffic by any means. Scoops are traffic. One of the biggest shocks to the online world was the launch of TMZ. The blog was developed by AOL in 2005, and revenues skyrocketed to nearly $20 million a year almost immediately, paving the way for its now famous television program. This was all accomplished through a handful of major scoops, or at least TMZ's special definition of scoops. The blog's founder, Harvey Levin, once said in an interview that TMZ is, quote, a serious news operation that has the same rigid standards that any news operation in America has, end quote. This is the same site that once published, at 4:07 a.m., an exclusive scoop, a blurry, never-before-seen photo of future President John F. Kennedy on a boat filled with naked women. This exclusive scoop was headlined, "The JFK Photo That Could Have Changed History." Only it couldn't have altered world events for one simple reason. The man in the photo wasn't JFK. In fact, it turned out to be a spread from a 1967 issue of Playboy. Oops. Despite missteps like this, TMZ turned scoop getting into a science. They broke the story of Mel Gibson's anti-Semitic outburst during his DUI arrest, and then got video of Michael Richards' racist onstage meltdown, posted the bruised Rihanna police photo, and announced the news of Michael Jackson's death. TMZ originated four of the biggest stories to come from the internet and captured a substantial audience from these enormous surges of traffic. They don't think of Deadspin. They don't think of Defamer, Gawker's predecessor to TMZ, which was shuttered because it couldn't deliver any scoops, and they don't like Perez Hilton's silly little drawings anymore either. It sent a very clear message to publishers. Exclusives build blogs. Scoops equal traffic. The thing is, exclusive scoops are rare, and at the very least, they require some effort to obtain. So greedy blogs have perfected what is called the pseudo-exclusive. In a private memo to his employees, Nick Denton, founder and publisher of the Gawker Media blog empire, asked the writers to use this technique because it allows them, quote, to take ownership of a story even if it isn't a strict exclusive, end quote. In other words, pretend they have a scoop. The strategy works well because many readers will see the story only in one place. They have no idea that it was actually broken or originally reported elsewhere. One of Gawker's biggest scoops early on in the race, certainly a TMZ-level story, was a collection of Tom Cruise Scientology videos. It is a good example of a pseudo-exclusive, since the work wasn't done by the site who eventually got all the page views from it. Since I witnessed the story unfold behind the scenes, I know that the tapes were actually unearthed by Hollywood journalist Mark Ebner, whose blog I was advising at the time. Ebner called me, very excited with news of a potentially huge scoop, and said that he'd bring over the materials. A few hours later, he gave me some DVDs in an envelope marked confidential, which I watched later that night with a friend. Our stupid reaction: Tom Cruise being crazy? How is that new? Gawker had a different reaction. See, Ebner had also shown the clips to his friends at Gawker, who turned around and immediately posted a story featuring the videos before Mark or anyone else had a chance to. I don't know whether Gawker promised Mark they'd give him credit. All I know is what happened was shitty. Their post went on to do 3.2 million views and bring their site a whole new audience. Mark received nothing because Gawker didn't link back to his site, which would have been the right thing to do. By doing this, Gawker owned a story that was not theirs. Only after did I begin to understand how blog fortunes were made. off the backs of others. When all it takes is one story to propel a blog from the dregs of the internet to mainstream notoriety, it shouldn't come as a surprise that sites will do anything to get their shot, even if it means manufacturing or stealing scoops, and deceiving readers and advertisers in the process. Established media doesn't have this problem. They aren't anxious for name recognition, because they already have it. Instead of bending the rules and the truth to get it, their main concern for their business model is to protect their reputations. This is a critical difference. Media was once about protecting a name. On the web, it is about building one. Using names to build a name. Blogs are built on scoops and traffic, and this is made possible by big names. The economics of the internet value consistent hitters, and so one of the safest bets a site can make is to lock up an all-star or A-list blogger to helm their business. Like so much of the history of blogging, this trend begins with Gawker. Sort of. In 2004, Jason Calacanis, the founder of Weblog Inc., poached editor Pete Rojas away from Gizmodo, at the time the dominant gadget blog owned by Gawker. He gave Rojas a small equity stake in his company, and together they founded Engadget, which quickly surpassed Gizmodo as the reigning champion of scoops and big stories. After founding Engadget, Rojas created another site for Calacanis, this time a video game blog called Joystick, which became another enormously popular site. Next, there is Andrew Sullivan, who makes Rojas look like a minor league player. Sullivan's name and blog, The Dish, is one of the most sought after to build a site around. His now decade-old site was first leased by Time Magazine's website and spent several years under their domain. He was then stolen away from Time.com by TheAtlantic.com to bring digital life to their faltering print publication. Sullivan delivered. His daily dish would eventually draw more than 1 million visitors each month to The Atlantic. Like any franchise athlete, they were able to build a team around him, using his name to attract writers and influential readers. In 2011, Sullivan left for the Daily Beast in order to cite the cycle all over again, but the bump in traffic and prestige stayed at The Atlantic. The Daily Beast, fresh from its merger with Newsweek, was equally desperate for traffic and name recognition and was willing to pay serious money for a shot at Sullivan's brand-building power. Bringing in big online names is now a go-to move for sites trying to build traffic. The New York Times brought the Freakonomics blog under their umbrella in 2007 and later did the same with Nate Silver's 538.com. B5 Media launched Crushable.com and TheGloss.com under the charge of notorious Gawker founding editor Elizabeth Spears. The Huffington Post built most of its original cachet by having celebrities blog on the site, a rarer feat then than it is now. The list goes on and on. All these bloggers, from Sullivan to Rojas to Spears, got their high-paying gigs, and often a percentage of a site's revenue, because they built big names for themselves. Their strategy is the same as their publishers. Build a brand by courting controversy, breaking big scoops, driving comments, and publishing constantly. And their big deals with sites like the New York Times and the Daily Beast make these questionable tactics all the more necessary. The big names have to stay big to stay on top. The BlogCon, names, scoops, and traffic create an exit. I've written about how sites engage in an endless chase for revenue through page view, and that is what they do. However, blogs are not intended to be profitable in independent businesses. The tools they use to build traffic and revenue are part of a larger play. Blogs are built to be sold. Though they make substantial revenues from advertising, the real money is in selling the entire site to a larger company for a multiple of the traffic and earnings, usually to a rich sucker. Weblogs Inc. was sold to AOL for $25 million. The Huffington Post was sold to AOL for $315 million in cash, with its owner, Arianna Huffington, deliberately eschewing the opportunity to wait and build for an IPO. TechCrunch was sold to AOL for $30 million. Discovery bought the blog Treehugger for $10 million. Ars Technica was sold to Condé Nast for more than $20 million. Know Your Meme was acquired by Cheeseburger Media for seven figures. Fox News Interactive purchased the sports blog Yardbarker. I worked on an acquisition like this myself when The Collective, a talent management company I advise, bought Bloody Disgusting, a blog about horror films, with an eye on potentially selling it to someone bigger down the line. Blogs are built and run with an exit in mind. This is really why they need scoops and acquire marquee bloggers, to build up their names for investors, and to show a trend of rapidly increasing traffic. And the pressure for this traffic in a short period of time is intense, and desperation, as a media manipulator knows, is the greatest quality you can hope for in a potential victim. Each blog is its own mini Ponzi scheme. for which traffic growth is more important than solid financials, brand recognition more important than trust, and scale more important than business sense. Blogs are built so someone else will want it, one stupid buyer cashing out the previous ones, and millions of dollars are exchanged for essentially worthless assets. Anything goes in the den of thieves. It doesn't surprise me at all that shady business deals and conflict of interest abound in this world. My favorite example, of course, is myself. I am regularly the online ad buyer and the publicist or PR contact for the clients I represent. So the same sites that snarkily cover my companies also depend on me for large six or even seven-figure checks each year. On the same day a writer for a blog might be emailing me for information about a rumor they heard, their publisher is calling me on the phone asking if I want to increase the size of my ad buy. Later in this program, I'll tell you about how difficult it is to get bloggers to correct even blatantly inaccurate stories. This conflict of interest was one of the only effective tools I could use to combat that. Naturally, nobody minded what I was doing because they were too busy lining their own pockets to care. Michael Arrington, the loudmouth founder and former editor-in-chief of TechCrunch, is famous for investing in the startups that his blogs would then cover. Although he no longer runs TechCrunch, he was a partner in two investment funds during his tenure and now manages his own, Crunch Fund. In other words, even when he is not a direct investor, he has connections or interests in dozens of the companies on his beat, and his insider knowledge helps turn profits for the firm. When criticized for these conflicts, he responded by saying that his competitors were simply jealous because he was, I'm not kidding, quote, a lot better than them, end quote. So when Arrington blew the lid off a secret meeting of angel investors in Silicon Valley in 2011, later known as Angelgate, it's hard to say whose interests he was serving, his readers or his own. Or maybe he was upset not because collusion is wrong, but because the group had declined to invite him, and again, not kidding, treated him rudely when he showed up anyway. He ultimately left TechCrunch after a highly publicized fight with the new owners, AOL, who dared to question this conflict of interest. Nick Denton of Gawker is also a prolific investor in his own space, often putting money in companies founded by employees who left his company or were fired. He has stakes in several local blog networks, such as Curbed, that are often linked to or written about on his larger sites. By shuffling users around to two sites, he can charge advertisers twice. Denton also invested in the site CityFile, which he was able to pump up with traffic from his other blogs before acquiring it outright and rolling it back into Gawker. Influence is ultimately the goal of most blogs and blog publishers, because that influence can be sold to a larger media company. But as Arrington and Denton show, influence can also be abused for profit through strategic investments, be it in companies they write about or where they decide to send monetizable traffic. And of course, these are only the conflicts of interest blatant enough to be discovered by the public. Who knows what else goes on behind the curtain? Enter the manipulator. Bloggers eager to build names and publishers eager to sell their blogs are like two crooked businessmen colluding to create interest in a bogus investment opportunity, building up buzz and clearing town before anyone gets wise. In this world, where the rules and ethics are lax, a third party can exert massive influence. Enter the media manipulator. The assumptions of blogging and their owners present obvious vulnerabilities that people like me exploit. They allow us to control what is in the media, because the media is too busy chasing profits to bother trying to stop us. They are not motivated to care. Their loyalty is not to their audience, but to themselves and to their con. While ultimately this is a reason to despair, I have found one small solace. Conning the con men is one of life's most satisfying pleasures, and it's not even hard. In the next chapters, I will outline how to do this, and how it is being done. I have broken down the manipulation of blogs into 9 effective tactics. Each exposes a pathetic vulnerability in our system. Each, when wielded properly, levels the playing field and gives you free rein to control the information on the web. Chapter 4. Tactic number 1. Bloggers are poor. Help them pay their bills. The writings by which one can live are not the writings which themselves live, and are never those in which the writer does his best. Those who have to support themselves by their pen must depend on literary drudgery, or at best, on writings addressed to the multitude. John Stuart Mill, Autobiography. There are many ways to give someone a bribe. Very rarely does it mean handing them a stack of bills. You use this logic, and the criteria that bloggers' employers use to determine the size of their paycheck, the stuff bloggers are paid for, can be co-opted and turned into an indirect bribe. These levers were easy enough for me to find. and properly identified and wielded, they turned out to be as effective as any overt payoff. It begins with how these bloggers are hired. Put aside any notion that applicants are chosen based on skill, integrity, or a love of their craft. Ben Parr, editor-at-large of the popular technology blog Mashable, was once asked what he looked for when he hired writers for his blogs. His answer was one word: quickness. Online journalism is fast-paced, he explained. Quote, we need the people that can get the story out in minutes and can compose the bigger opinion pieces in a couple hours, not a couple of days. End quote. As to any actual experience in journalism, that would be considered only, quote, a definite plus, end quote. The payment structure of blogging reflects this emphasis of speed over other variables, such as quality, accuracy, or how informative the content might be. Early on, bloggers tended to pay their writers a rate per post or a flat rate with a minimum number of posts required per day. Engadget, Slashfood, and Autoblog, and other sites run by Weblogs Inc., paid bloggers a reported $500 a month in 2005 for 125 posts, or $4 a post, 4 per day. Gawker paid writers $12 a post as late as 2008. And of course, those rates don't include the other duties bloggers are stuck with, such as editing and responding to emails and writing comments. Professional blogging is done in the boiler room, and it is brutal. Gawker set the curve for the industry again when they left the pay-per-post model and switched to a page view-based compensation system that gave bonuses to writers based on their monthly traffic figures. These bonuses came on top of set monthly pay, meaning that bloggers were eligible for payments that could effectively double their salary once they hit their monthly quota. You can imagine what kind of results this led to. I remember a post from a Gawker writer whining about how he didn't know how much money he'd make that month and getting 17,000 views for it. The bonus system was so immediately rewarding for Gawker bloggers that the company tweaked their ratio to de-emphasize the bonus slightly. The system remains, however, and today the company has a big board in its offices that shows the stats for all the writers and their stories. When writers aren't fighting for bonuses, all they have to do is look up and be reminded. If you're at the bottom of the board, you might get fired. This is now the standard model for blogs. Forbes.com was relaunched with hundreds of blogger contributors who are paid per visitor. Seeking Alpha, a network of financial writers, arguably worth a lot to its investor-type readers, launched a payment platform in 2010 that pays writers based on the traffic their posts generate. The average payment per article turned out to be only $58 for the first 6 months. A writer needs to rack up roughly 1,000 page views to make even $1,000, a tough fight when you're jostling for share of voice against the 1,000-plus writers who publish there each month. The blog The All announced it would start paying its writers using a similar model 2 years after its founding. A dozen or so bloggers split a small pool of revenue generated by the advertisements on the site. The more traffic the site does, the larger the pool. It's the same incentive, desperately dependent on big hits, but instead of fighting each other for page views, they're all in on the hustle together. Business Insider, run by Henry Blogget, is barely breaking even, so they don't have much to pay their writers. Earlier experiments with highly paid, experienced journalists failed to work. When he does pay his writers, Blogget has a fairly simple rule of thumb. Writers need to generate 3 times the number of page views required to pay for their own salary and benefits, as well as a share of the overhead, sales, hosting, and Blogget's cut. In other words, an employee making $60,000 a year needs to produce 1.8 million page views a month, every month, or they're out. This is no easy task. Google and YouTube pay their video bloggers solely on how many views they get, once they've been verified as a quality producer. In other cases, Google will greenlight just one hit video from an account and allow that to be monetized. YouTube sells and serves the ads, taking a substantial cut, and then passes on the rest. Most of these figures are not public, but a decent account can hope to make about 1 penny per view, or about $1 for every 1,000. I remember working for the very popular multi-platinum rock band Linkin Park and realizing that their account, which had done over 100 million views, would barely earn them 6 figures. To be split among 6 guys, a manager, a lawyer, and a record label. These kinds of rates force channels big and small to churn out videos constantly to make money. Every view is only a penny in their pocket. Twitter users are straight up mercenary. Through various ad networks, you can actually pay influential Twitter accounts to tweet a message of your choosing. And by message, I mean they will tweet anything. In order to promote one of Tucker's books, I got a Twitter account with more than 400,000 followers to say, fact, people will do anything for money, for $25. For a few $100 more, I tricked dozens of other accounts into posting humiliating promotional messages that pushed the book to a number two debut on the New York Times bestseller list. One blog headline summed it up well. Tucker Max proves that you can pay celebrities to tweet whatever you want. Other companies such as Demand Media, Associated Content, and Examiner.com have revived the earlier payment model and typically pay their writers on a per post and per video basis. The figure for text tends to hover around $8, slightly more for video. If these numbers sound small, and they do to me, it isn't simply because bloggers are getting shafted, because what they produce isn't worth all that much. Political analyst Nate Silver estimated that the median user-contributed article on the Huffington Post is only worth $3 in revenue to the company. So even if they were paid fairly for their contributions, it wouldn't be much of a paycheck. Silver looked at high-profile articles by former U.S. Secretary of Labor Robert Reich that did 547 comments, 27,000 page views, and concluded that they'd be worth only about $200, an amount for which a man like that usually wouldn't get out of bed. Most articles from the currently unpaid contributors generate significantly less revenue than that. Ripe for exploitation. All this means that if bloggers want to get rich, or even cover their rent, they've got to find other ways to get paid. That's where people like me come in, with boatloads of free stuff. One of the quickest ways to get coverage for a product online is to give it away for free to bloggers. They rarely disclose their conflict of interest. At American Apparel, I have two full-time employees whose job it is to research fashion bloggers, girls who post photos of their outfits each day to thousands of readers who imitate them, and send them our newest garments. I would offer an affiliate ad deal to the most popular girls that would pay them a commission each time someone bought something from our site after seeing their photos. I'm sure you're shocked to read how often their posts featured something from American Apparel. When I promoted movies, tours of the set or invitations to the premiere worked wonders in getting blog coverage. When I worked with bands, concert tickets or even just an email from the artist can make most blogs starstruck enough to give you what you need. And that's nothing compared to what Samsung did. As an advertiser on Business Insider, Samsung paid for a Business Insider staffer to go to Barcelona to cover the Mobile World Congress. Thankfully, the writer disclosed this relationship, but in that very disclosure, he cops to feeling, quote, pretty warm and fuzzy about Samsung, end quote, as a result of the generous offer. In my line of work, it's all about encouraging those feelings, however possible. But this is just free swag and perks. The easiest way for bloggers to make real money is to transition to a job with an old media company or a tech company. They can build a name and sell it to a sucker, just like their owners and investors are trying to do. Once a blogger builds a personal brand, through scoops or controversy or major stories, they can expect a cushy job at a magazine or a startup desperate for the credibility and buzz that these attributes offer. These lagging companies can tell shareholders, see, we're current, or we're turning things around. Tony Pierce, a founding editor of LAist, a local blog about Los Angeles, left it to head up the digital efforts for the Los Angeles Times. CNET blogger Caroline McCarthy turned in her blogging gig for a job at Google as a trend analyst. Yahoo, in its days as a media company, hired a whole slew of bloggers away from their websites, including reporters from Defamer and MovieLine.com, The All, and others. Reporter John Cook left the Chicago Tribune to join Gawker, left Gawker to join Yahoo, and then left Yahoo to return to Gawker, all in less than 2 years. A former editor with Engadget, Joshua Topolowski, is a regular guest on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon and a weekly columnist for the Washington Post. The founding editor of Wonkette, Anna Marie Cox, is the queen of the revolving door. She turned her few years as a blogging celebrity into stints editing and reporting for Time.com, MSNBC, Air America, and Playboy. This revolving door has a peculiar influence on coverage, as is to be expected. What blogger is going to do real reporting on companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter when there's a potential for a lucrative job down the road? They'd prefer to play it safe and build their name by any means but being a reliable journalist. For my part, I've lost track of the bloggers whose names I've helped make by giving them big stories, favorable and to my liking, and watched them transition into bigger gigs at magazines, newspapers, and editorships at major blogs. In fact, the other day I was driving in Los Angeles and noticed a billboard on La Cienega Boulevard with nothing but a large face on it. The face of a video blogger who I'd started giving free clothes to back when his videos did a few thousand views apiece. Now his videos do millions of views, and he has a show on HBO. If you invest early in a blogger, you can buy your influence very cheaply. In most cases, they know what I am doing and don't care. If blog publishers are constantly looking for an exit, then their bloggers are too. They both want money from the same big media companies. They don't care if the scandals they write about are real or made up, or if their sources are biased or self-serving. as long as the blogger gets something out of it. The real conflict of interest. We take it as self-evident that bloggers shouldn't be paid off by the people they write about or have financial investments, like owning a stock they're reporting on, in their field. The conflict would shape the coverage and corrupt their writing. So for a second, I was pleasantly surprised to read pretty much that exact sentiment in a post by Gawker writer Hamilton Nolan titled, New Rules for Media Ethics. He said it plainly, quote, media people, reporter, commentator, or otherwise, shouldn't have a financial stake in what they're reporting on, end quote. But then I realized how hypocritical it all was. Since Nolan is being paid by how many views his posts do, his financial interest isn't in what he writes about, but in how he writes it. In the pay-per-page view model, every post is a conflict of interest. It's why I've never bought influence directly. I've never had to. Bloggers have a direct incentive to write bigger, to write simpler, to write more controversially, or conversely, more favorably, to write without having to do any work, to write more often than is warranted. Their paycheck depends on it. It's no wonder they're vicious, irresponsible, inaccurate, and dishonest. They call it a digital sweatshop for good reason. Ceaseless fight for table scraps might be a better phrase for it. Or in the immortal words of Henry Kissinger, the reason the knives are so sharp online, because the pie is so small. Chapter 5, Tactic Number 2, Tell Them What They Want to Hear. Even though credibility is all you have to sell, it's not enough anymore. Credibility is not working as a business model. Credibility of journalism is at an all-time low anyway. Kelly McBride, Poynter Institute. The problem of journalism, says Edward J. Epstein in his book Between Fact and Fiction, is simple. Journalists are rarely in a position to establish the truth of an issue themselves, since they didn't witness it personally. They are, quote, entirely dependent on self-interested sources, end quote, to supply their facts. Every part of the newsmaking process is defined by this relationship. Everything is colored by this reality. Who are these self-interested sources? Well, anyone selling a product, a message, or an agenda. People like me. When the New York Times publishes leaked documents, there is an implicit understanding that they have at least attempted to verify their validity. The same goes for the identity of the source who gave it to them. Online, anonymous means something else entirely. Quotes and tips are drawn from unsolicited, untraced emails, or angry comments pulled from comment sections, or sent in by people who have something to gain from it. I know because I have been this source dozens of times. It was never for anything important. My identity is never verified. Today, the online-driven news cycle is going a million miles a minute in a million directions. The New York Times may still try to verify their sources, but it hardly matters, because no one else does. This creates endless opportunities for people like me to slip in and twist things to my liking. As Epstein says, the discrepancy between what actually happened and the version of what happened provided by sources is an enormous gray area. Of all such areas, it's where I have the most fun and direct influence. The deliberate leak. Once, during a lawsuit, I needed to get some information into the public discussion of it, so I dashed off a fake internal memo, printed it, scanned it, sent the file to a bunch of blogs as if it were an employee leaking a memo we got from our boss. The same bloggers who were uninterested in the facts when I informed them directly gladly put up exclusive and leaked posts about it. They could tell my side of the story because I told it to them in words they wanted to hear. More people saw it than ever would have if I'd issued an official statement. Another time I had some promotional images for a Halloween campaign I also couldn't use because of copyright concerns. I still wanted them seen, so I had one of my employees email them to Jezebel and Gawker and write, quote, I shouldn't be doing this, but I found some secret images on the American Apparel server, and here they were, end quote. The post based on this lie did 90,000 views. The writer wrote back a helpful tip. No need to leak me info from your company email address. You might get caught. I thought, but how else could she be sure they were real? It was funny at the time. Then a few months later, a U.S. congressman allegedly exchanged emails with a girl on Craigslist and sent her a shirtless photo of himself. The girl forwarded this photo and the incriminating email correspondence, which supposedly occurred along with them, to Gawker, which owns Jezebel. Gawker posted it, and the congressman immediately resigned. Knowing now that an anonymous tip to Gawker has the power to end the career of a United States congressman took a little fun out of it for me. Scratch that. Now my personal knowledge of Gawker's sourcing standards scares me shitless. Press release 2.0. When I first started in PR, all of the leading web gurus were proclaiming the death of the press release. Good riddance, I thought. Journalists should care too much about what they're writing about to churn out articles and posts based on press releases. I could not have been more wrong. Before long, I came to see the truth. Blogs love press releases. It does every part of their job for them. The material is already written, the angle laid out, the subject newsworthy, and since it comes from an official newswire, they can blame someone else if the story turns out to be wrong. As a 2010 study by Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism found, quote, as news is posted faster, often with little enterprise reporting added, the official version of events is becoming more important. We found official press releases often appear word for word in firsthand accounts of events, though often not noted as such. So I started putting out press releases all the time. Open a new store, put out a press release. Launch a new product, put out a press release. Launch a new color of a new product, press release. A blogger might pick it up. And even if no outlets do, press releases through services like PRWeb are deliberately search engine optimized to show up well in Google results. Indefinitely. Most important, investing sites like Google Finance, CNN Money, Yahoo Finance, and Motley Fool all automatically syndicate the major release wires. If you're a public company with a stock symbol, the good news is that any release you put out shows up right in front of your most important audience, stockholders. Minutes after you put it out, it's right there on the company's stock page in the recent news section, eagerly being read by investors and traders. I quickly learned that not everyone saw this as a harmless, low-hanging media fruit. My instinct is not a legal profit, but for those who have it, blogs' blind faith in press releases presents opportunities. It did for New York stockbroker Lambros Ballas. He was charged by the Securities and Exchange Commission for issuing fake online press releases about the stocks of companies like Google, Disney, and Microsoft, and seeding them on blogs and finance forums. On the fake news of an acquisition offer from Microsoft, shares of Local.com jumped 75% in one day, after which he and other traders dumped all their shares and moved on to pumping other stocks on fake news. It's stunning how much news is now driven by such releases, reputable or otherwise. A LexisNexis search of major newspapers for the words in a press release brings back so many results that the service actually attempts to warn you against trying, saying, quote, this search has been interrupted because it will return more than 3,000 results. If you can continue with this search, it may take some time to return this information, end quote. Same goes for the phrase announced today and told reporters. In other words, newspapers depended on marketing spam literally too many times to count in the last year. A Google blog search for said in a press release, meaning they quoted directly from a release, brings back 307,000 results for the same period as the LexisNexis search, and more than 4 million for all time. Announced today brings up more than 32,000 articles for a single week. If you get specific, an internal search of TechCrunch brings up more than 5,000 articles using announced today, and 7,000 attributed citations to press releases. This pales in comparison to the Huffington Post, whose bloggers have written the words announced today more than 50,000 times and cited press releases more than 200,000 times. And of course, there's also Talking Points Memo, whose name unintentionally reveals what most blogs and newspapers carelessly pass on to their readers. Pre-written talking points from the powers that be. Anyone can now be that power. Anyone can give blogs their talking points. To call it a seller's market is an understatement. But it's the only thing I can think of that comes close to describing a medium in which dominant personalities like tech blogger Robert Scoble can nostalgically repost things on his Google Plus account, like the original pitch for publicity that the iPad startup Flipboard had sent him. It's a great time to be a media manipulator when your marks actually love receiving PR pitches, not even needing to be the source. Bloggers are under an incredible pressure to produce, leaving little time for research or verification, let alone speaking to sources. In some cases, the story they're chasing is so crazy that they wouldn't want to risk doing research because the whole facade would collapse. From my experience, bloggers operate by some general rules of thumb. If a source can't be contacted by email, they probably can't be a source. I've talked to bloggers on the phone only a few times, ever, but thousands of times over email. If background information isn't publicly or easily available, it probably can't be included. Writers are at the mercy of official sources such as press releases, spokesmen, government officials, and media kits, and these are the instances that they even bother to check anything. Most important, they're at the mercy of Wikipedia, because that's where they do their research. Too bad people like me manipulate that too. Nothing illustrates this better than the story of a man who, as a joke, changed the name of comedian and actor Russell Brand's mother on Wikipedia from Barbara to Juliet. When Brand took his mother as his date to the Academy Awards shortly after, the Los Angeles Times ran the online headline over their picture, Russell Brand and his mother, Juliet Brand. I remember sitting on the couch at Tucker Max's house one January a few years ago when something occurred to me about his then on-and-off-again bestseller. Hey, Tucker, did you notice that your book made the New York Times bestseller list in 2006, 2007, and then in 2008? Meaning that the book had appeared on the list at least once in all those 3 years, not continuously. So I typed it up, sourced it, and added it to Wikipedia, delineating each year. Not long after I posted it, a journalist cribbed my research and did us the big favor of having poor reading comprehension. He wrote, Tucker Max's book has spent over 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list. And then we took this and doubled up our citation on Wikipedia to use this new, more generous interpretation. This is a cycle I have watched speed up, but also descend into outright plagiarism. I can't divulge my specifics, but I commonly see uniquely worded or selectively edited facts that paid editors inserted into Wikipedia show up later in major newspapers and blogs with the exact same wording. You'll have to trust me on when and where. Wikipedia acts as a certifier of basic information for many people, including reporters. Even a subtle influence over the way that Wikipedia frames an issue, such as criminal charges, a controversial campaign, a lawsuit, or even a critical reception, can have a major impact on the way that bloggers write about it. It is the so-called difference between so-and-so released their second album in 2011 and so-and-so's first album was followed by the multi-platinum and critically lauded hit. You change the descriptors on Wikipedia, and reporters and readers change their descriptors down the road. A complete overhaul of one high-profile starlet's Wikipedia page was once followed less than a week later by a six-page spread in a big tabloid that so obviously used our positive and flattering language from Wikipedia that I was almost scared it would be its own scandal. That's why you have to control your own page, or you risk putting yourself in the awkward position a friend found himself in when profiled by a reporter in a national newspaper who asked, "So, according to Wikipedia, you're a failed screenwriter. Is that true?" Trust me, I'm an expert. It's not a stretch to convince anyone that it's easy to become a source for blogs. Cracking the mainstream media is much harder, right? Nope. There's actually a tool expressly designed for this purpose. It's called Haro, Help a Reporter Out. And it is a site that connects hundreds of self-interested sources to willing reporters every day. The service, founded by PR man Peter Shankman, is a wildly popular tool that connects journalists working on stories with people to quote in them. It is the de facto sourcing and lead factory for journalists and publicists. According to the site, nearly 30,000 members of the media have used Haro sources, including the New York Times, the Associated Press, the Huffington Post, and everyone in between. What do these experts get out of offering their services? Free publicity, of course. In fact, free publicity is Haro's tagline. I've used it myself to con reporters from ABC News, to Reuters, to the Today Show, and yes, even the vaunted New York Times. Sometimes I don't even do it myself. I just have an assistant pretend to be me over email or on the phone. The fact that my eyes light up when I think of how to use Haro's services to benefit myself and my clients should be illustrated. If I was tasked with building someone's reputation as an industry expert, it would take nothing but a few fake email addresses and speedy responses to the right bloggers to manufacture the impression. I'd start with using Haro to get quoted on a blog that didn't care much about credentials. Then I'd use that piece as a marker of authority to justify inclusion in a more reputable publication. It wouldn't take long to be a nationally recognized expert who's been featured in blank, blank, and blank. The only problem is that it wouldn't be real. Journalists say Haro is a research tool, but it isn't. It's a tool that manufactures self-promotion to look like research. Consider alerts like, urgent. Email redacted at AOL.com needs new and little-known resources, apps, websites, etc., that offer families unique ways to save money. 10 days later, the reporter generously gave a second marketer a chance at the same story with this request. Urgent. Email redacted at AOL.com needs new or little-known app or website that can help families with young kids save money. On occasion, I have instructed a client to say something in an interview, knowing that once it is covered, we can insert it into Wikipedia and will become part of the standard media narrative about them. We seek out interviews in order to advance certain facts, and then we make them doubly real by citing them on Wikipedia. This is not a noble effort by a reporter to be educated, but an all too common example of a lazy blogger giving a marketing an opportunity to insert themselves into their story. Journalists love to put out bulletins asking for sources to support stories that they are already writing. Email redacted at gmail.com needs a horror story related to mortgages, student loans, credit reports, debt collectors, or credit cards. Urgent, email redacted at abc.com, is looking for a man who took on a new role around the house after losing his job. There you have it, how your bogus trend story sausage is made. In fact, I even saw one horror request by a reporter hoping to, quote, speak with an expert about how fads are created. I hope whoever answered it explained that masturbatory media coverage from people like her has a lot to do with it. What Haro encourages, the site is filled with thousands of posts asking for it, is for journalists to look for sources who simply confirm what they were already intending to say. Instead of researching a topic or communicating their feelings to the public, journalists simply grab obligatory but artificial quotes from experts that validate their page view journalism. To the readers, it appears as legitimate news. To the journalists, they are just reverse engineering their story from a search engine friendly premise. Haro also helps bloggers create the false impression of balance. No one is speaking to sources on both sides. They're providing token space to the opposition and nothing else. It is a sham. I constantly receive emails from bloggers and journalists asking me to provide a response from some absurd rumor or speculative analysis. They just need a quote from me denying the rumor, which most people will skip over, to justify publishing it. Most stories online are created with this mindset. Marketing shills masquerade as legitimate experts, giving advice and commenting on issues in a way that benefit their clients and trick people into buying their products. Blogs aren't held accountable for being wrong or being played, so why should they avoid it? Forgetting my own bullshit. As I was gathering up press done on me personally over the years, I came across an article I'd forgotten. I posted a question on my blog. What is the classic book of the 80s and 90s? It was a discussion I'd had with several friends, and we were wondering what books teachers would assign to students to learn about this era 50 years from now. This discussion was picked up and featured by Marginal Revolution, a blog by the economist Tyler Cowen, which does about 50,000 page views a day. His post said, "What is the classic book of the 80s and 90s? That's Ryan Holiday's query. This is not about quality. This is about representing a literary era, or perhaps just representing the era itself. I'll say Bonfire of the Vanities and Fight Club as the obvious picks. Loyal MR reader Jeff Rizzi is thinking of Easton Ellis, though not American Psycho. How about you? Dare I mention John Grisham's The Firm as embodying the blockbuster trend of King, Steele, Clancy, and others? There's always Harry Potter in graphic novels." Coming across this struck me not only because I'm a big Tyler Cowen fan, but because I am also Jeff Rizzi, or was, since that's one of the fake names I used to use, and had apparently emailed my post as a tip to Marginal Revolution. Of course Jeff Rizzi was thinking about Bret Easton Ellis. He's one of my favorite authors. I even answered a variant of that question.